In these trying times, the United States knows that we will always have a friend in Taiwan. And we will not shy away from telling the rest of the world that they can rely on Taiwan too.
The United States edges closer to Taiwan. This is Wednesday, the 12th of August, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Remember, you can find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, we hear from one of those U.S. NGO leaders sanctioned by China. The Trump administration changes its stance on foreign students in the United States. It is all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar attacked China's response to the coronavirus pandemic Tuesday and said that if such an outbreak had emerged in Taiwan or the United States, it could have been snuffed out easily.
The Chinese Communist Party has had the chance to warn the world and work with the world on battling the virus, but they chose not to, and the costs of that choice mount higher every day. As the virus emerged, the People's Republic of China did not live up to the binding obligations it had under the international health regulations, betraying the cooperative spirit we need for global health. I believe it is no exaggeration to say that if this virus had emerged in a place like Taiwan or the United States, it might have been snuffed out easily, rapidly reported to public health authorities who would have shared what they knew with health professionals and with the general public. We have had successful cooperation and engagement with the PRC on a few issues, including on some areas in health. But on the most important health challenge of this century, genuine cooperation was lacking. I'm so pleased to be here today to thank Taiwan for setting a positive example and for choosing enthusiastically to be a part of the global health community. Your contributions have never been more appreciated than they are today. In these trying times, the United States knows that we will always have a friend in Taiwan, and we will not shy away from telling the rest of the world that they can rely on Taiwan too.
Azar arrived in Taiwan on Sunday as the highest level U.S. official to visit in four decades, a trip condemned by China. Taiwan has been praised by health experts for its early and effective steps to control the outbreak, with only 480 infections, including seven deaths. China considers Taiwan a breakaway province and has vowed to bring it under its rule by force if necessary. Chinese fighter jets Monday briefly crossed the median line of the sensitive Taiwan Strait and were tracked by Taiwanese anti-aircraft missiles, part of what Taipei sees as a pattern of harassment by Beijing. Azar is in Taiwan to offer not just the administration's support for its democracy, but to learn about its successful fight against the coronavirus pandemic. Taiwan has kept its infection numbers low thanks to early and effective prevention efforts. Azar said the world should recognize Taiwan's health accomplishments, pointing to Taiwan's exclusion from the World Health Organization due to Chinese objections, which considers Taiwan merely a wayward province. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. President Trump says his relationship with Chinese President Xi Jinping has frayed in the wake of the pandemic. Thailand's prime minister says protesters went too far after they called for a 10-point plan for monarchical reform. Rival protests take place in Bangkok, with dozens of students continuing week-long calls to change the constitution. South Korea continues to see historic levels of rainfall, further threatening an economy already battered by a coronavirus-related lockdown. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. China on Monday announced unspecified sanctions against 11 U.S. politicians and heads of organizations promoting democratic causes, including Senators Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, who have already been singled out by Beijing. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said the 11 had performed badly on issues concerning Hong Kong, where China has cracked down on opposition voices following its imposition of a national security law in the semi-autonomous southern Chinese city last month. Four other lawmakers were named by the foreign ministry, Senators Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton and Pat Toomey, and Representative Chris Smith. The others sanctioned were National Endowment for Democracy President Carl Gershman, National Democratic Institute President Derek Mitchell, Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth, Michael Abramowitz, the President of Freedom House, and International Republican Institute President Daniel Twining. Adriana Zhang of the VOA Mandarin Service spoke with Twining on his inclusion on that list.
Our reaction at IRI is that this is a diversion from the extraordinary crackdown that the Chinese Communist Party is conducting in Hong Kong. They are trying to divert their citizens and the world with charges of foreign collusion against Hong Kong activists with this sanctioning activity. We don't even know what this means. Frankly, I think a lot of Chinese and certainly a lot of Hong Kong citizens will see this as a sign of weakness, not strength.
Mm-hmm. So when we say that China imposed sanctions on you, like what's included in the sanctions?
We don't know. It seems symbolic. Obviously, there's some tit for tat with the U.S. government for sanctions imposed on a select group of Chinese officials. The Chinese did impose sanctions on a number of Republican senators. One thing the Chinese Communist Party is trying to do is turn support for freedom in Hong Kong into some kind of partisan issue. I know that Democratic Party leaders care just as much about freedom for the Hong Kong people as Republican politicians and party leaders do.
What's your view on the current situation in Hong Kong?
That it's dire, that even the most peaceful and reasonable and mainstream critics of the Chinese Communist Party are being hauled off on fake charges. There is no indication whatsoever that the Chinese Communist Party is willing to abide by any of its agreements. And, you know, Hong Kong was an international agreement with the British government and the global community. And so I do think a lot of countries now are looking at the Chinese crackdown in Hong Kong. They're not seeing it as a domestic issue. They're seeing it very much as a sign that the Chinese Communist Party cannot be trusted to uphold agreements, and that what the Chinese Communist Party does to its own citizens, it could inflict on the rest of the world. I mean, the extraterritoriality provisions of the national security law that the CCP imposed on the Hong Kong government would punish anyone in the world from saying anything about freedom in Hong Kong. So the Chinese Communist Party is making a global claim to control speech, which is remarkable and will not work. We saw millions of people in the streets of Hong Kong over the past year. The Chinese Communist Party can impose a draconian set of laws. They can throw Hong Kong democracy leaders in prison, try them on fake charges. Our sense is that it's only going to embolden more Chinese to ask what's wrong with their government that will not submit itself to any form of electoral accountability to its citizens, actually isn't defending the best interests of its citizens. It's defending the regime against its own citizens, and that it's unlikely to be able to hold for long.
The number of Americans named by the ministry exactly equals the number of Hong Kong and Chinese officials placed on a sanctions list by the United States last week over the crackdown. Happening now in Asia, police in Indian-controlled Kashmir said Tuesday they're investigating allegations by three families that three of their relatives were killed by the military in a staged gun battle and buried as unidentified militants. Police claim they're taking all necessary steps to ascertain facts in the case. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. This is VOA Asia. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says authorities have found four cases of the coronavirus in one Auckland household from an unknown source. The first reported case of local transmission in the country in 102 days. Arden says Auckland, the nation's largest city, will be moved to alert level 3 from midday Wednesday through midnight Friday, meaning that people will be asked to stay at home while bars and many other businesses will be closed. The country has been praised globally for its virus response. Meanwhile, senior government officials in the Australian state of Victoria appear at a parliamentary inquiry into the response to the COVID-19 crisis. Premier Daniel Andrews and other colleagues were expected to face questions about security breaches in the hotel quarantine system for travelers returning from overseas. Australia has had 21,397 confirmed coronavirus infections. 313 people have died. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia has equaled its deadliest day of the coronavirus pandemic so far. 19 people in the state of Victoria have died in the past 24 hours, and 331 new infections have been reported. The city of Melbourne is in lockdown until mid-September, and a nighttime curfew is in place. Its streets are almost deserted, as millions of people are forced to stay at home. Only essential businesses can stay open. 19 deaths were recorded in Victoria in the past 24 hours, equaling Australia's deadliest day so far. But with daily new infections near a two-week low, there is hope that the tide may be turning. Dr. Nick Coatsworth is Australia's Deputy Chief Medical Officer.
This is about Victorians, particularly those under Stage 4 restrictions, but also those under Stage 3 restrictions, getting reward for their efforts. And when we do see it, I think we will all be very happy to see that curve inflect downwards again.
There are claims that infected passengers returning from overseas have been responsible for the second surge of infections in Victoria. Foreign nationals are banned from Australia, but citizens and permanent residents can return home. They face a mandatory 14-day period in hotel isolation. State Premier Daniel Andrews is due to face a committee of lawmakers about security flaws that allowed passengers who tested positive for COVID-19 to spread the virus into the community. A separate judicial inquiry into the hotel quarantine system has heard that security flaws were responsible for Victoria's recent wave of infections. The psychological impact of the pandemic in Victoria is also emerging. The number of patients seeking mental health treatment in hospitals has increased sharply. The state's health minister is Martin Foley.
For young people under 18, we've seen a 33% increase in presentations for people with self-harm in emergency departments.
Dozens of people have been fined for ignoring the curfew in Melbourne and refusing to wear a mask. Victoria is at the centre of Australia's COVID-19 crisis. Neighbouring New South Wales has Tuesday recorded 22 new infections, its highest daily number in almost 4 months, as a cluster linked to a school in Sydney continues to rise. The disease appears to be under control in other Australian states and territories. For VOA News, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
AP correspondent Sagar Magani takes a look at the epidemic worldwide.
Johns Hopkins University's tally shows there are now 20 million confirmed cases worldwide. Health officials believe the actual number is much higher, given testing limitations and the fact that as many as 40% of those with the virus show no symptoms. It took fewer than 3 weeks for the tally to rise from 15 million. The U.S. now has about a quarter of the global cases at 5 million and counting, though President Trump is again chalking that up to a testing boost.
It's very interesting because we're so far ahead of testing, we have more cases. If we had much smaller testing, would have fewer.
More than 163,000 people have died from the virus in America. Sagar Magani, Washington.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Singapore started crushing 9 tons worth of elephant ivory Tuesday in what authorities say was the biggest such event globally in recent years, signaling the island nation's fight against illegal trade in wildlife. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Facing 8 federal lawsuits and opposition from hundreds of universities, the Trump administration Tuesday rescinded a rule that would have required international students to transfer or leave the country if their schools held classes entirely online because of the coronavirus pandemic. The decision was announced at the start of a hearing in a federal lawsuit in Boston brought by Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. U.S. District Judge Allison Burroughs said federal immigration authorities agreed to pull the July 6th directive and return to the status quo. The unexpected decision was welcome news to international students who are struggling to make plans for the fall term. We have documented the many challenges facing both students and parents deciding whether or not to send their students back to school as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. One of our interns at VOA Asia has faced an even more trying experience. Ji-hee Wu came to us in Washington, D.C. from South Korea. I spoke with her about her experience. You have one of the most unusual internships of anyone we've ever had at the Voice of America. What happened?
This year was pretty tough for the whole world. And for as an intern from abroad, it was also a very tough time, I would say. So usually what we expect when I am in the United States and doing an intern would be like experiencing the workplace and getting a chance to get along with like other people, and that's what I've expected. But since the pandemic started, I couldn't go to work, and I wasn't even sure that I could go to work, because actually my government was pressing me to go back to South Korea, and I was the one actually signed up the waiver and said that I'm not going to go back. I kind of refused.
What was the waiver?
So the waiver was this. So like for the program, they were kind of pushing everyone who was attending this program to go back to South Korea because they were not going to guarantee our health when we get coronavirus. So the waiver was about, okay, I had to sign and say that, okay, the government is not going to take any kind of responsibility when I get sick or when I get the virus, and I'm the one who have to cope with everything. And they're just like kind of giving us up, like, okay, you have to come back, but if you refuse, that means then you have to take care of yourself by alone. So that was the waiver about.
Well, what we haven't brought up yet is the pandemic and the COVID-19. You got it. How'd you get it? What did it feel like? What did it do to you?
So I am telling you that I was super cautious about this virus. I did everything. I have a bunch of masks from Korea, back in Korea, really good ones. And I would never take off my mask, even though when I go out or just for a walk, I would always have my masks on, always sanitizing myself. And I was like really cautious. But I can tell that like this virus, you don't know where you get it. You just don't know. I am not sure even where I got it.
How bad was it, and what did you do to take care of it?
When I was starting working, I was like, oh my God, I'm so tired. I didn't know why, but I was very, very tired. The next day, actually, I started to have some runny nose and headaches. So I was like 100% sure I got the virus. So I did my quarantine since then, and I went up to the testing site and I got the virus. They told me that I got the virus, and that was the day I started to feel some shortness of breath and also lots of chest pains.
So how did you take care of it? Did you just ride it out? Did you see a doctor? What happened?
I couldn't go to the hospital. I knew that they cannot do anything for me because there is no treatment for coronavirus. Fortunately, I did not have fever and I did have my medicine kit in my house. So I didn't go to the doctor. What I did was eat lots of vitamin C, lots and lots of vitamin C. So like I would have a good immune system so my body can fight with the virus. So yeah, I ate lots of orange, vitamin C, and I tried to eat well, but because I didn't taste anything.
So are you? But you're free of it now, right?
Yeah, I got negative, and I am done with coronavirus right now.
Jihee has completed her internship with us and is now making her way back home to South Korea.
How dangerous is COVID-19? 80% of the cases are said to be mild. Young and healthy people are at a relatively low risk. Elderly and people with serious health conditions are at risk of fatality. If you have a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
We continue on VOA Asia. The World Health Organization is releasing guidance on measures to be taken by dental health professionals and patients in oral health services to minimize the risk of being infected with COVID-19. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A World Health Organization survey of 103 countries between May and mid-July finds COVID-19 has affected dental services around the world in unprecedented ways. Dental officer in WHO's Department of Non-Communicable Diseases, Benoit Varenne, says 75% of survey respondents reported dental services have been completely or partially disrupted because of the coronavirus.
As you know, dentists, dental nurses, hygienists, and dental assistants work in close contact with patients and are exposed to saliva and blood. And also they are using what we call spray generating equipment. And all this equipment are generating what we call airborne particles or aerosol.
In communities where transmission of the coronavirus is high, Varenne says WHO recommends priority be given to urgent or emergency oral cases. And in the treatment of patients, he says dental workers should avoid or minimize procedures that may generate aerosols, which can spread the infection, and prioritize the use of hand instruments. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We continue on VOA Asia. By the year 2025, half of the world's population, according to the World Health Organization, will be living in areas that are considered water-stressed. Several companies are offering solutions to clean and available drinking water by looking at what is in the air. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details.
This is no ordinary water cooler. The water here comes from the air. Having access to clean drinking water is a growing global problem. Several companies have developed technology that uses moisture in the air and transforms it into drinking water. WaterGen's technology first purifies the air of particles. The air is then cooled until it reaches dew point. The water goes through another series of filters and an ultraviolet lamp to destroy microorganisms. These bigger machines have helped supply safe drinking water in countries including Sierra Leone and Vietnam, and also in the United States during disasters such as hurricanes. This smaller unit, called the Jenny, for the home or office, can produce an average of 30 liters of water a day.
WaterGen says the humidity in the air should be around 30% to maximize what this technology can do.
When you get up closer to 50, it works brilliantly.
Higher humidity also works better for atmospheric water solutions, AquaBoy. Similarly, it creates drinking water while purifying the air and dehumidifying the room. Zero mass water produces drinking water from sunlight and air, even in places of low relative humidity, using these hydro panels. The technology uses solar energy to raise the dew point inside the hydro panels, creating condensation. The cost of these various products run from around $2,000 and up, which may cost too much for households in many regions in the world. Creating drinking water from air, one solution that could alleviate one of the most basic human needs. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Thank you for being with us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, and that includes Keith Lane, Jim Stevenson, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.